WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Having a famous writer as a father is a hard act to follow, especially if you want to be a writer yourself. Ben Cheever is the son of John Cheever, the Pulitzer Prize-winning short story writer and novelist. Ben Cheever worked as an editor at Reader's Digest for 10 years before he edited a collection of his father's letters and turned to writing full-time. He then wrote his first novel, published in 1992, called, of all things, The Plagiarist. His newest novel, called The Partisan, is a humorous and touching portrait of the family of Jonas Collingwood, a critically acclaimed and publicly ignored writer of gloomy novels. Collingwood has been offered a hefty advance to write a memoir of his experiences in World War II. The book is to be called The Partisan. In Ben Cheever's hands, the novel explores the powerful dynamic between Collingwood and his adopted son Nelson, the corrosive nature of family secrets, and the futile quest for happiness. It's narrated by Nelson Collingwood. Ben Cheever works at home these days, writing and taking care of his children. He's married to New York Times film critic Janet Maslin. Let's begin with a reading from the opening of The Partisan.
That was the summer I worked for the Westchester Commons. I was in love with Amy Snodgrass Rose. Amy was in love with David Hitchens. David was in love with Gloria Thomas. I was in Westchester. Amy was in Washington State. David was in Montreal. Gloria had gone to Paris. The sex was very safe, and I was very lonely.
What I like so much about that is a kind of rhythm that you set up, and also, of course, the humor that moves through that paragraph, but also throughout the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to work at that?
When I was a kid, people thought I was funny, and I would try and write funny things, and sometimes I'd write one funny thing, and then I'd try again, and I'd write something that wasn't funny, and there's nothing more awful than something that's supposed to be funny and is not. Then, when I started really spending a lot of time writing, I discovered that what you wrote was something sad, and it turns out to be funny. If you wrote something that happened that was sad, and you made it a little sadder than it was, and you tell it to people, they think it's hilarious.
And why is that? Because it's happening to someone else and not them? The difference between comedy and tragedy, of course.
That's right, is it's happening to someone else. I think that's part of it, but I think also sadness creates humor. I mean, you laugh at sad things. When my father died, the day the family all got together to go to the funeral, we were all in hysterics. And at the funeral, in fact, people were quite critical. But that's just how we react to things that we find unpleasant.
How would you describe Nelson? And he's the person that tells the story.
Well, I like him a lot, but he's more an observer. He's less active than maybe he ought to be. He's not sure what he wants. He wants desperately to be liked. And one of the critics who didn't like the book said that this was adolescent, and that Nelson cares terribly about having people love him, and this is an adolescent phase. And I'm 45, and I still desperately care about having people like me. I don't know what I'm supposed to go on to. I mean, what is if you don't terribly want the approval of other people, then what is it you do want? Do you want money? Is that more important than the approval of other people? Do you want fame? Do you want cleaner highways? I don't know what it is that's more important than having other people like you.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from this book, and this is the beginning. It's actually on page 55.
All right.
Right here. This is chapter 6.
Okay. I'm glad you asked me to read this, because in some ways I think it's the heart of the book. I've always been mystified by the interest adult adopted children take in their biological parents. They appear on TV, they write books, they are careful to explain that they have wonderful adoptive parents, but still they want to track down the real ones. What in God's name are these people looking for? Don't they know that by the time they're 21, they've had the only childhood they're entitled to? There's something ridiculous about the search, those big, sad faces yearning for a missing babyhood. They should get drunk instead, or hit somebody, or cry. Bloodlines have always seemed to me to be entirely beside the point. Love is a choice. Families are made, not found. Those pivotal connections are forged by some mysterious alchemy of tenderness and cruelty, not by the matching of genetic fingerprints. What is this mania for real parents? Your real parents are the ones you have. Romulus and Remus were suckled by a wolf. They founded Rome. Winston Churchill was brought up by a nanny. He hardly even saw his biologicals. Once you're raised, you're raised. Don't some gestalt therapists claim that it's never too late for a happy childhood? Nonsense. It's conceivable that the victim of a disastrous upbringing can become happy, or at least a successful adult, but he'll never become a happy child, not unless you drop him on his head. Still, I suppose I should take the time to explain how it was that Sister and I came to be raised by strangers. I'm not as interested in this as are the viewers of 60 Minutes, but here it is. We were both adopted by Elspeth's sister Lily and by her husband Hamilton Ballard. The Ballards lived across the Hudson in Montvale, New Jersey. They were childless. Hamilton, a lawyer, was deeply involved in school politics. When a bright young girl whom he had been counseling got pregnant, he was the first one she told. She was then a senior at the local high school with a full scholarship to a distinguished college. The father was said to have been an auto mechanic. The unborn child threatened to ruin her life. The Ballards sent Miss X to a lodge in New Hampshire, and in the fullness of time, they adopted the baby boy. That was 1971. I was that baby.
And that's my guest, Ben Cheever, reading from his latest novel called The Partisan. As a parent, do you feel the tug of biology? Are you immune to that? When you look at your sons, you say, I made that?
No, I don't say I made that. It seems very mysterious to me that this other creature is so complete. Should have any biological connection to me. And when I first saw a baby, the first time I ever saw a baby that was mine, my reaction was horror.
Horror?
Well, yes. We had a black Labrador, and when she had puppies, I remember she was shocked. She thought, I guess, that she was constipated, and suddenly there was this little yowling thing, one of many, it turned out. And her first reaction was fright and horror, and that was my first reaction to being a father. This entity, and children seem to bring their own destiny with them, really, into the world, with its own needs.
Well, and what interests me in that section is that it seems to run counter to a certain trend to reclaim a childhood, to go back and take one's teddy bear, spiritual teddy bear, one's actual teddy bear, and try to recapture, relive a certain elusive happiness. And does that bother you, this trend to reconstruct childhood and do it right somehow?
Well, it does bother me. I think what bothers me most is the idea that we can be made happier by blaming our parents. And obviously part of the reason I take this position now is I'm becoming more a parent and less a child. But I think that's an unhelpful way of looking at life. I don't think blame works. I don't think it's a good thing to get too heavily involved in.
Where do you think that comes from? Because it seems very culturally driven.
Well, I don't know. I think there's an unwillingness, and this may be because of advertising, to accept how difficult life is. I think life is difficult. I think it's difficult for parents and for children. It's difficult for rich people and poor people. I think it's really tough, and we're not supposed to accept that. It's supposed to be fun. We're supposed to always be buying great things that are making us happy and our lives simpler, and we're supposed to love everyone around us, and that's not my experience. So I find life disappointing, and one way to solve that disappointment is to blame my terrible parents.
Did you go through a period of that?
Well, sure. I mean, we all do. I certainly did. A period where I felt alienated from them. I felt that they were part of a world that was corrupt and that I was never going to be part of, that they were hypocritical, that they were overly materialistic, that they didn't love each other in a way that I accepted, or me. I remember screaming at my father once, you don't know anything about love. You don't know the first thing about love. And I think a lot of the things I thought about them were true, but what I didn't understand was why they felt that way and how hard it is not to feel that way and how hard they had worked and what sacrifices they had made for me.
My guest is Ben Cheever. His latest novel is called The Partisan. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist Ben Cheever. His latest novel is called The Partisan. Well, this book is also about family secrets, and of course, all families have them, and I don't want to give the end of the story away either. But Would you say that the secrets are always destructive? Because there's sometimes a fine line between secrets and privacy, and privacy even within the own within a family.
Well, I'm not sure secrets are always destructive. My father had a big secret, which was that he was bisexual, and it was. I have very mixed feelings about that. I don't think he would have been the wonderful writer he was if he hadn't been the person he was, and the person he was bisexual. He was actively homophobic, or talked that way when he was around and before he came to grips with this at the end of his life, and that confused me. I think it might have been better. I'm pretty sure it would have been better for me if I'd known earlier that that he had very mixed feelings about homosexuality.
And my understanding is that he told you about his bisexuality just a couple of weeks before he died.
Right.
When he told you that, did it explain some certain things? Did it turn your head around a little bit?
Yeah, it spun my head around. I was confused for quite a while afterwards. I'm still a little confused about it. But but I'm not sure that he would have been a happier person had he lived a different life. I think he lived the life he wanted to live. There are people who think that he should have just expressed himself as bisexual early on and it would have been simple and he should not have had a family. There's a problem with that. If he'd not had a family, I wouldn't be around. Things are complicated, and I think he wanted to have a family, and I think he was a pretty decent father, and I think my mother and he loved each other, sometimes very intensely, and sometimes they hated each other, but I think that's what happened.
And what you're saying is confusing is the impulse to choose to be either heterosexual or homosexual, and that bisexuality somehow is even more confusing than those two ends of the spectrum?
Well, what was confusing to me was that I was taught or led to believe, not entirely by him, also by other people, that relationships with women were always going to be dangerous and mysterious, and that I was always in danger when I was in the presence of a woman I found attractive, but that relationships with men, because the sexual element was entirely missing, were safe, and I could be comfortable and noisy and messy around men, and it wouldn't be held against me. And then suddenly I discovered that I was quite mistaken about this, and that there was a sexual element in relationships with men much more than I'd seen it. And that was very confusing to me.
Did you think when you realized or you were told by your father that he was bisexual that then you would be bisexual, or that whatever sexuality you thought you had, you didn't have?
I had a little while there where I thought, well, probably it was possible that I was married at this point. And I thought, well, maybe I am gay, and the reason I wasn't is because I was so frightened of his disapproval. And I waited for my gayness to express itself, and it didn't. And I noticed that when I thought of being naughty, it was always with a woman. So I thought that probably I wasn't gay, and gay men have told me that this is not an arbitrary decision they make. This is something that's made for them.
Let me get back to something that you wrote about and about working at home. You said that you look for adult companionship, at least be able to sort of check in with someone during the day as you're home working and taking care of the kids. Do you call women? Do you call men?
Well, if it's been a real bad day, a lot of times I have my mother come over. She'll come over in the evening and help me with the kids, and we can talk a little bit. I call my sister a lot, too. During the day, if I can, I'll run with another guy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more apt to be mixed. In the old days, all my friends were men, and I had a lot of very good men friends. And that's not true now.
Are you a pretty dedicated runner?
Yeah, I'm a compulsive runner.
Okay.
Is what I am.
Which means how much do you run?
Well, it means that I recently, just in the last couple of weeks, I've been going to the gym. But it means I run 45 minutes a day, every day. I have a ski machine, so when I absolutely can't go out, I can do it inside. And if I don't do it, I get in a terrible mood. And I will get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do it if I have to. It's a drug. I think it's less harmful than some other drugs, but it's a drug, and I miss it terribly if I don't have it. And I'm quite selfish about it, too. I
mean, what do you get?
Well, I've got a little voice in the back of my head that says that I'm a jerk. And if I pause, if I'm not completely involved, this little voice kicks in and it says, "You're a jerk, Ben." And if I run hard for 40 or 45 minutes, it shuts up. It's not replaced with a voice that says, "You're great," but it just shuts up. And that's a wonderful thing.
Which is enough, right? Yeah. Are you working on another book?
That's right. I'm about, I hope, a third of the way through a third novel.
Some writers love writing. Some of them love rewriting. Some of them love editing. Is there a part that you enjoy?
I love getting something right, or close to right. That's very, very gratifying. I will put it off any way I can, and I make myself do it every day, because if I didn't do it every day, I probably wouldn't ever do it again.
Really?
Yeah, every time I get away from it. Well, then I sit down and I think, you know, why don't you get a job? Why are you sitting here by yourself imagining something? Why would anyone be interested in that? Whereas if I do it every day, it's a habit. I don't have to ask
that. And that's that voice that says you're a jerk?
Yeah, it says you're a jerk. And why would you think you're a novelist? I mean, what a pretentious title for a person to take on.
Novelist Ben Cheever is the son of writer John Cheever. Ben Cheever's latest book is called The Partisan. This is Fresh Air.